Good morning. I'm an economist by training, so as you might guess, what I'm going to talk about today is foreign policy, which is an economic issue for multiple reasons, but we won't go into that. But in the post-Cold War period, the main threat to the United States and other Western nations comes from weak, failed, and conflict-torn states. The best way of dealing with this threat is an open issue. Classical liberals are often accused of having little, if anything, to say regarding foreign policy. My experience is that classical liberals are typically accused of supporting some form of pacifism combined with isolationism. This stands in stark contrast to many conservatives, and some moderate liberals who call for a more active foreign policy, where the U.S. intervenes in global affairs to achieve some mix of stability and global public goods. A major challenge for the current generation of classical liberals is to overturn the inaccurate view that classical liberals have nothing substantive to contribute to the discussion on foreign policy. I believe there are several concrete steps that classical liberals can take to clarify their views on foreign policy while making a significant contribution to the ongoing debate on this topic. Today, I will briefly discuss four of these steps. One, emphasizing the distinction between the know what and the know how. Policymakers and academics have a clear view of what a liberal economic, social, political institutions look like. However, they have a very poor understanding of how to establish these institutions where they do not already exist. That is, policymakers, suffer from a fundamental knowledge problem of how to plan and implement extended liberal social, political, and economic orders in foreign countries where they are not already present. This becomes evident when one looks at both the academic literature regarding the factors necessary for sustainable liberal institutions, as well as the United States record of success and failure in occupying countries using military force to bring about liberal democracy. The record indicates more failures than successes. Number two, highlighting the limits of the U.S. political decision-making process. The knowledge problem that I just mentioned focuses on the inability of policymakers and occupiers to possess the relevant understanding of how to construct liberal democratic institutions where they do not already exist. The actual implementation of policies is yet another challenge that is often overlooked when considering the viability of foreign interventions. Even if we are to assume that policymakers and occupiers possess the relevant knowledge and information to bring about the necessary institutional changes, would effective policies actually be implemented in practice? When one looks closely at the incentives faced by elected officials, bureaucrats, voters, and domestic and foreign interest groups, there is good reason to believe that the political process will distort the actual implementation of the policies and directives involved in foreign interventions. As public choice economics indicates, public actors must choose in a political institutional setting characterized by distorted incentives based upon biased information with a fundamental disconnect between costs and benefits of political actions. Even if policymakers are driven by the best of intentions, the political process will distort the intentions and often generate perverse outcomes. Number three, analyzing the costs and public bads associated with foreign intervention. Classical liberals can contribute to the debate on foreign policy by highlighting the negative aspects of foreign intervention. It is true that foreign intervention can generate positive benefits both domestically and abroad. But it is just as likely, if not more so, that interventions will produce significant costs and bads, both domestically and internationally as well. These costs include, but are no means limited to, the erosion of domestic civil liberties, the growth of U.S. government at home, blowback against the United States, increases in conflict abroad, and the prevention and destruction of indigenous institutions in foreign countries. Fourth, overturning the myth that classical liberals are isolationists. As I mentioned at the outset, classical liberals are often accused of being isolationists. Nothing could be further from the truth. Historically, isolationism combines non-intervention abroad with some form of economic nationalism, whereby legal barriers to economic and cultural exchange are established and enforced. While it's accurate to characterize many, if not most, classical liberals as holding a position of non-intervention, few, if any, support a position of isolationism. In fact, I would contend that many conservatives tend to support economic nationalism to a much greater degree than most classical liberals. The classical liberal position is a cosmopolitan one, emphasizing the economic and cultural benefits of free trade. This is hardly as inward-looking as those that employ the isolationism label wish it to be. In stark contrast, classical liberals argue that the correct foreign policy is one that leads to increasing interconnectivity with the rest of the world instead of more isolation from it. It is critical for classical liberals to emphasize the significant economic and cultural benefits of free trade and the importance of such a policy in the post-9/11 world. In sum, classical liberals have much to contribute to the ongoing debate regarding foreign policy. The challenge facing the next generation is clearly communicating these ideas in an effective manner that demonstrates their superiority when compared to the alternatives. Thank you very much.